Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live on the Heritage Radio Network in the back where of Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Brought to you today again, I assume, by the Modernist Pantry. Is that correct?
That is correct.
We'll be reading there.
Our printer's broke, so I'll be reading it, I guess.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Nice. You're going to read it with feeling, with gusto?
I'll do my best.
Yeah? All right.
But you do have a caller on line one.
All right. So, anyone else who's waiting, call in to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi. Hello.
Howdy.
Sorry, I'm Tammy. I'm calling from Sydney, Australia.
Wow.
I'm a bit safe right now.
Cool.
Hello. I did have a couple of questions. One about meat glue.
Mm-hmm.
One about infusing truffle flavor, and one about MacGyvering a sous vide.
Very good. You're not affiliated with the Today Tonight Show, are you?
No. Right. No, unfortunately.
Yeah,
no.
Very good. All
right. Okay.
Because, you know, they're the ones in Australia. They're the ones in Australia who had the anti-meat glue thing. You remember that? Did you see that?
Sorry?
Did you see, in Australia, Today Tonight Show, they were the people that had the anti-meat glue telecast. Did you see that back when it aired about a year ago?
Weirdly enough, I saw it on your blog rather than on TV.
Strangely. All right.
Which kind of shows you how much TV I watch. But what I was watching, though, was your science and cooking lecture with Harvard. Very enjoyable. I now clarify all my liquid using agar-agar.
Nice.
What I did notice that you said when you were talking about your mokume gane fish was that there was a small amount of ammonia produced when you were using meat glue.
Correct.
And I was wondering about, you know, you said on the primer in your blog that this dissipates before you eat it. Now, does it dissipate, like, through cooking? Is it, you know, if you're dealing with raw foods, especially fish, is it really good to, you know, backpack it, take out the backpack and then weight it? Or, like, is there any particular dissipation thing going on? Or
yes,
how does that work?
That's an excellent question. So for those of you that don't know what we're talking about, meat glue is an enzyme that we use to bond different proteins together. When it's doing that bonding, a small amount of ammonia is produced in the reaction. And in fact, you can use the reaction as a gauge for how strong your meat glue is by dipping something like raw chicken into the meat glue and smelling it and making sure that you have that aroma that a reaction is taking place. Mokume gane is a Japanese metalworking technique where different layers are laminated together and then sanded flat and have a wood grain kind of appearance. So a number of years ago, I did a recipe with fish, different colored fish. They're layered together. And then cut on a slicer so you get a wood grain effect with the fish where the very thin layers are glued together. And that that recipe, I put some salt and sugar, so it's cured, but it's not cooked. And so when I originally did that recipe, I did notice the aroma kind of the meat glue because it was a very thick block. I had overused the meat glue. And so it was noticeable. And that thing had been in a vac pack all the way up until the time it was sliced. So to remedy that, I used much less meat glue the subsequent times that I made that recipe. And I also vacced it to compress it, but then cut it out of the vac pack and let it sit. And all of the ammonia dissipate. Ammonia very volatile, right? So it's going to dissipate. In fact, there's baking powders that are based on ammonia that are used specifically for cookies. They bake out over time. But if you put them in something that's super thick, right, or you don't cook it enough, they taste horrible because the ammonia is still there. So ammonia is volatile, will leave, especially in a cooked item. It's not a problem ever, really, but in the fish, I noticed, you know, that it was a problem. Additionally, I've run tests where if you add a boatload of meat glue to something that's cooked in a bag that's never taken out of the bag, that some people can detect something even on a long cooked braise. But it takes a boatload of meat glue to do that.
Cool. And then, thank you very much. And the second question was, I heard that truffles are really good at dessert, and I really wanted to use the flavor of truffles in chocolate truffles, like a joke. So I was wondering what the best way maybe to infuse because I know truffles infuse really well into butter, but then to make the ganache, it's just chocolate and cream, right? So
right.
I'm not quite sure what the best way to go around that.
You can use butter in a ganache instead. I mean, I've done plenty of butter ganaches. You just have to find a butter-based... Or you could infuse directly into the cream if you wanted to use cream, but I do plenty of butter-based work. I mean, the textures are going to change so much, but I mean, I've done plenty of butter and chocolate ganaches you can infuse into, or you could infuse directly into the cream. A good way to infuse something like a truffle, where it's expensive and you don't want to lose a lot of aroma, is to infuse it in a vacuum bag so that you...
Oh.
Yeah, right. Just put it in a vacuum bag, suck it, and then basically everything stays contained in there, and you're not going to be volatilizing a lot of the aroma of the truffle.
Cool. I didn't think about that.
Yeah. If you have access to a vacuum machine. If not, you could. If you have access to a vacuum machine. If you don't, you could use a Ziploc or something like that.
Okay. And my third question was about MacGyvering a sous vide machine. So there were discussions I had one night with my friends about how expensive sous vide machines are and so on and so forth. And somebody suggested modifying a deep fryer with a dial setting and a really high-quality tropical fish tank water pump.
Right.
Would you recommend not recommended, or, how well do you think that would work?
Well, fortunately, there are tons of people out there that are selling kits right now for doing basically what you really need is a temperature control. I mean, the pump, yes, you can use an aquarium pump. There's any one of a number of pumps you can get in the sub $20 range that will circulate, right? The problem with a deep fryer, a couple problems with a deep fryer. Well, it depends. Like, I don't know what kind of deep fryers you're looking at, but most of the deep fryers that they sell here don't have exposed elements. And if they don't have an exposed element, you're not going to get very good heat transfer. So you're going to get a lot. It's going to be hard to get a nice steady temperature. Do you know what I mean? You might get some porpoising, or it's going to take a long time to get up and be accurate. If you have something with an exposed element, great, it'll work fine. The problem I have with deep fryers or any contained vessel like that is you're really limited in the size of what you can cook. So what you basically need is a PID temperature controller. These can now be had for on the order of $30 US, right? You're going to need some sort of a solid state or regular relay. Again, these now can be got for like $7. A Type K thermocouple for temperature measurement, waterproof one. That's another $7. So now you're at like $14, $30, $35. A pump for another $20. Now you're at $55. And then you're going to need the heating element. Now, a heating element, you could really use anything. There's lots of really cheap immersion heating elements out there. The trick is just not to electrocute yourself.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I did a project once just for giggles where I, whopped up a bunch of stuff that I had gotten on eBay, and I bought a bunch of immersion coffee heaters, the really cheap, like, $3 ones you get at the local dollar store. And it worked. You want to try to get at least up to about 1,000 watts of heating, which is what the standard commercial ones do. But I stuck my hand into the water, and because there's a lot of leakage current out of those things because they weren't very well constructed. Do you know what I mean? I mean, no one's expecting you to stick.
Right.
Yeah, right. No one's expecting you to stick your hand into your cup of coffee, and so they don't care so much that there's a little bit of leakage coming out of the heater, right? But you care very deeply whether you get electrocuted when you're putting your hand into a water bath to pull out a piece of food. So that's something to look at. But, there are tons of, I don't know in Australia, but I know here in the U.S. we have a bunch of suppliers. And there's I know that there's suppliers in Australia because I've been thwarted by trying to buy something and found out it was an Australian website. So I know that there's people out there that are selling this kind of stuff. So you should be able to get everything all told working for under $100. Now, the problem then is like trying to get a nice enclosure. And that's where a lot of the DIY projects that are out there are really kind of cool. cool because they find, like, you know, like with DIY stuff, there was a rage, I guess it's still a rage, to put everything into an Altoids tin, right? Like projects that could fit in an Altoids tin. So the miracle, So the miracle is finding the cool box to put everything into. And I forget what it was. There's some acrylic box out there that is readily available that works really well with a bunch of off the shelf parts to make a circulator. But I can't remember what that box was. But, you know, thank God for the internet.
Thank you so much, by the way.
Hey.
Yes, I shall go and try that. And if I get electrocuted, you'll know about it.
All right, super. Thanks for calling in all the way from Australia.
So, you have three callers.
Cool. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, thanks very much. Oh, wait, we have another caller?
We have three who have been waiting.
So all right, caller. Keep it shorter. You're on the air.
Hey, Dave, how you doing?
How you doing?
Pretty good. I'm actually, now that you got a call from Australia, I'm calling from Moscow, believe it or not.
Wow, this is awesome. This is great. Moscow, welcome.
And, hey, great. Actually, a native New Yorker living in Moscow, and I have a question for you. I'm redoing my kitchen, and it's basically a simple equipment question. What do you get? What should I get in terms of a gas burner so I can, you know, have some, you know, enough BTUs to cook in a wok, for example, or... You know, and of course, the last question, and I'm sure it's your favorite, is the espresso. I need an espresso machine, and what should I get?
What's the water like in Moscow?
It's pretty bad. I'm going to probably be using bottled water.
Okay. So, I mean, one of the great joys of having a decent water supply is that you can get a plumbed espresso machine, which is, I love, instead of having to, like, constantly dump water in the back. I'm assuming you could probably filter or, you know, the problem then with certain filtering techniques like reverse osmosis on espresso machines, you really don't want RO water for your espresso because it's too pure. You know, it doesn't have enough minerality in it. So if you're working from bottled, you can retrofit a commercial machine to use bottled. I don't really know what's available in Russia in terms of equipment, but I mean, what level of espresso machine are you looking at cost-wise?
No, I'm willing to pay for a little bit here, but I can definitely not don't have the space to do like a whole pump setup.
Right. I mean, there are lots of, I mean, so the prosumer units,
hello,
you still there? Yeah. The prosumer units that are out there, I haven't had a lot of experience with them. I have experience with the smallest commercial units, which are like the single group guys, and they're fairly compact. I don't know if you have the space for them, but I mean, they're good. I only have mine's from the, you know, the 80s or 90s, I guess, because I don't have the money for a new one. They're having had a dual group espresso machine, the single groups aren't as temperature stable. I don't have a lot of experience with the newer, like for instance, one Ken Ingber, our listener, who's trying to get me to get the Breville one. I don't have experience with that guy yet. I don't know how good it is, but you know, the things you're going to be looking for are temperature stability. I mean, you might want to go if you're into like tricking stuff out. I don't know whether it's still considered pulling a good shot, but there are a lot of people have modified Silvias in a very small package, Ranchillos. I'm sure it's been superseded, but the espresso geek community, they've, you know, done a lot of modifications on home machines to get them to pull a really good shot. It's just a little more fidgety than having a pro machine, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I mean, I would do one of those single shot pro machines, you know, like a restaurant style. I might go for that, but then I would need a pump, wouldn't I?
Well, they have a lot smaller pumps. The company that makes most of the pumps for the machines, you know, here is a company called Procon. And the reason the pumps are so big is because it's the same size pump. It can handle literally gallons per minute, even though you only need to put out like 60 milliliters over the course of 25 seconds or less, really, 30 milliliters, you know what I mean? So they throw away a lot of their output, and that's one of the ways that they regulate pressure. Procon knows that the pumps are oversized, and so they built a much smaller pump unit. I don't know whether any of those have made it into the newer machines yet, because the big pumps are literally just way overkill in terms of size. They're just unneeded. The other style of pump that's used is a vibrating pump. Most of those are made by a company in Europe called Ulka, and those basically, it's a little solenoid, crack, 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 and you can hear them, the vibrating pumps, and they just go back and forth. The problem with those is that it's thought that their pressure isn't as even as the larger rotary Procon pumps, and so some people have a gripe about whether or not it's possible to get get the same shot quality with those. I don't have a lot of experience with them. I don't know that the argument that people make that they can't pull as good a shot is good or not, but those pumps are radically smaller. And if, right. if you have a problem with the shot of that, what you can do, if they don't already do it, is put something called an accumulator on the backside of the pump, which is basically just a chamber of air. You could probably modify a soda bottle or something to do it, and it'll just even out any sort of vibration by having like an air, you know, an air cushion there.
Right, makes sense.
Yeah, and so you could go that way. As far as, do you have a Chinatown in Moscow? I've never been to Moscow.
No, they do not have a Chinatown in Moscow. That's one of the things. I mean, I could probably get, you know, if I can get something installed, that would be good. I mean, I do go home quite a bit, so I can always pop down to Chinatown in the city.
Yeah, I mean, because it's very simple and very cheap here to get a wok burner. You know what I mean? Like a ring, basically just a ring of fire that you hook up to a gas supply. And then all you'd need is an adapter to go to whatever the common gas plumbing is that you have in Russia. And you'd be good to go. But those are so cheap. Now, you could, I mean, I've never done it. I've never set up a straight-up wok burner, but I see them all the time on the streets here in Chinatown. They're just so cheap compared to trying to build that thing yourself, because you'd have to bend the black pipe into a circle, drill all the holes, tap them, put all the nozzles in, and then get your gas, your gas supply screwed in. It seems like a big hassle, especially if you're going to be home anytime soon. Probably easier to get it that way, and an adapter can't be that hard to come by. When you're in the States, if you know what kind of piping they have in Russia, I don't. You could get something. McMaster Car here probably sells an adapter, a metric pipe to a standard U.S. pipe taper, probably not that hard to get stateside and then bring it back with you. That'd be the way to go, I think.
I mean, if I was going to go for something slightly more commercial, like, you know, they have the five burner, you know, gas tops right now, where you can have the wok thing in the middle. Is there any way to maybe just buy one of those and try to jack up the BTUs, or is it just, you know, is that just for show?
Well, I'd have to play with one. I mean, the thing about a wok is it uses a preposterously high, number of BTUs per hour. It just dumps energy into the wok, and that's how it works. So a lot of the limitations in a particular burner have to do with how much gas is actually being supplied to it. Like, how much gas can you supply to it, and then can you combust it efficiently? So you probably have to... I mean, you might be able to mess around with it, like drill the orifice out bigger to get a bigger gas supply, but then you'd need to figure out a way to get enough air to it and make sure that it's combusting efficiently. Otherwise, you're just throwing gas away. You need actual more heat in there. So if you were going, you know what I'm saying? So you, I mean, anything's possible to do. I mean, you use regular natural gas there in Russia, right?
Yeah. It's pretty basic.
Yeah, I mean, you can always up the burner size. I mean, the good news is, I guess you don't need it to throttle down very low because you don't care about low heat outputs with a wok, so you can just have the thing scream. If you increase the orifice, we just got to make sure that you have enough ability to combust it. If you put too much gas through the smaller burners, you know, you'll just see the flame jumping out, but you'll have a big unburned area before it goes out, and you're just basically pumping gas into the air. Do you know what I mean?
Right. No, that won't be good for the kids.
No, but what you can do is if you can look up the size of a regular wok burner, you can get one of these things so it's all nice and finished. Rip out the old burner and throw a new one in. Do you know what I'm saying? That has the real kind of, you know, the fortitude that you need. And this kind of stuff I've done all the time. Or I've added a couple of extra 20,000 BTU. Like, I added a couple extra 20,000 BTU burners in my Salamander underneath so that I could have over and under fired Salamander one time for a project I was working on. So you can always add more burners with extra knobs on it, and those things will combust great. You know what I'm saying? So, like, if you have a space that you could drill in and add more heat, as long as you can get it kind of in a basic ring shape, you'd probably be good to go.
Yeah, that seems the way to go, because then it won't, you know, won't be sitting out on the side or something like that, taking up space.
Bingo.
So what in terms of other equipment, if you had your go-to equipment and you were gonna, you know, get something new, I'm happy to go esoteric, but, you know, what would you do?
I mean, you need a vacuum machine, circulator. I'd love to have if you have a infinite amount of gas supply. I mean, I've always wanted to have a Tandoor in my house. It'd be awesome. You know what I mean?
No, I got that at the country house. I was going to put it in the ground there.
Yeah,
out of the old Dacia. That's a great thing for out there, putting it in the ground.
Yeah, I mean, things, I mean, I have a PacoJet variant. I mean, I wish I had a real PacoJet. You know, vacuum machine obviously is awesome. Circulator. You need
the circulator is probably the thing to go for if I was going to go.
Yeah, really good blender. Like a VitaPrep. You know, next time you're in the States, bring one back. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and here's a good question. You know, in terms of buying, because buying equipment is because things are just outrageously expensive here. If I was to buy things, you know, in the city, is there a place to go that you know that does 220? I need 220.
Ooh, 220. You can buy direct from VitaPrep and have them drop shipped on 220. And also PolyScience will direct drop ship you to the States a 220 unit, and then you could bring it in as a carry back. You know, without having to worry about it. But I don't know of anyone that does direct to the customer sell of 220. I mean, you could deal with the JB Prince or something like that, and they could probably special order it from you. But PolyScience on a circulator would probably do that, and VitaPrep. I mean, the thing that's killing you is the taxes and the importing. You know what I mean? It's not the item itself. VitaPrep knows how to make a 220 VitaPrep. You know what I mean? Because I spoke to them about it. And, you know, same with PolyScience. I mean, their stuff, you know, it's pretty simple for them. It doesn't cost them more to make a 220 unit.
No, they sell them over here, but, I mean, in the States, let's say they're 500, and here they're 1,000. Over 1,000.
Yeah, so. by its stateside, it shouldn't be that much of a price penalty here. Maybe only like 10% instead of 200 or 100%.
Hey, Dave, we got a few more callers on the line.
Oh, all right.
That's cool. All right, Dave, thanks a lot. I appreciate it. Can't wait to try the bar.
All right, thanks so much.
Bye. Bye.
Hey, caller, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello.
Yeah, Dave, I have finally acquired a circulator after putting that off for half of forever, and I'm getting ready to drop a leg of lamb in it, or at least.
Hello?
Oops. Hello? Hi. Phone is doing very weird things.
That's all right. I still got you.
Okay. So, first and simplest question. If I'm doing a Kashmiri type leg of lamb in the circulator, can I put yogurt on it before it goes in the bag, or does that go wrong in some impressive way?
All right. So, you can. I have done kind of buttermilk. I haven't done yogurt in the bag. I've done buttermilk. I mean, you're going to get some, I mean, it's already curdled, so, you know, how's it going to curdle some more, right? I mean, it might break, the sauce might break, but, you know, the main thing that you're going to want to, so when you're adding yogurt to something, and I have much more experience, not with lamb, but with chicken, like if you're going to do like a chicken tikka, for instance, you know, the yogurt is, the acidity is basically there to tenderize. And so you're looking at kind of a tenderizing effect that they have. And I some people love the texture of, and let's go back to buttermilk because I have the most experience with it, buttermilk poaching in a bag. The problem with it is, especially on a very, very long cooking time, is that the meat can tend to mushiness, especially because you're not going to overcook it when you're using a water bath. Does this make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. So you're going to want to guard against mushiness in the meat on long cook times with acids in the bag. That said, you can have really, really spectacular, very soft meat results that some people really, really like. It's just, it's a question of whether for you personally, it tends to get to the mushy side.
All right. And do you have any guidelines on, like, at what point it's likely to really start going soft? It's 24 hours, 48 hours?
Yeah. 24, look, on a leg of lamb. Okay, so I mean the inherent problem with a leg of lamb is that the leg has so many different muscles that all want to be treated differently. This is why a leg of lamb is a very difficult piece of meat to have it all come together at the same time. If you cook a leg of lamb for 24 hours, there will be some muscles in the leg of lamb that are delicious, the ones that have more collagen in them, right? And then and more connective tissue in general. And then there are other muscles, ones that in the leg of lamb that are good with a very quick grill, let's say. Those ones are going to taste fibery if they're cooked for 24 hours. That said, sauce can make up for a lot You know what I mean? And so it's a question of what you're going to try and shoot for. I mean, look, in the end, your result is probably going to be better than what most people can attain anyway. But what you should start doing when you get a circulator and you start playing with it like you're doing is really focusing on kind of the minutia of what the textural differences are when you cook a piece of meat that long. If you have the time, which, you know, I don't know whether anyone does. I mean, not now, but ever later. Get like the same piece of meat, put it in 5 bags, and then cook each one, drop one in, you know, put one in, then, you know, 8 hours later, put another in. And so you can get a feeling for what a couple of hours here or there can do when you're cooking a piece of meat over a long period of time. And it's really worth the experiment to do it. Do you know what I mean?
It is.
Yeah.
No, I echo me. Okay, on a related question, very closely related, some portion of the chicken that I get in the Costco multi-packs,
right,
turns out to be absolute rubber.
A particular piece of the chicken?
Yes. I mean, like, you know, I don't know if you're a big Costco shopper or not, but, you know, they sell six vacu pouches of raw chicken breast. And each vacu pouch has 2 breasts, so you're buying 12 breasts in one, you know, in one package.
Right.
And, like, on some random basis, some number of those are like 7 times tougher than others.
That's bizarre. And presumably they're all being cooked in a similar fashion. You repeated this enough such that it's not just like, you know, one got cooked improperly or something like that.
I've had this problem at least 5 or 10 times.
It's very odd. Is it substantially different size, the one that's tougher?
They may be bigger. I mean, it's one of those. It's tricky to tell because I usually split them widthwise. So, like when I'm grilling them hot, that I can get the inside and the outside done at the same time.
Huh. Let me ask you this. Does it taste better?
Well, the texture is so funky, you almost don't get to the taste, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Because
when you bite it and it's just wrong.
Really, yeah, because, you know, older birds are radically, radically tougher, but I doubt they would sift some older birds in with the regular younger, because it doesn't make economic sense for them to do so. But older birds typically will taste much more like chicken. You know, like I went, you know, if you go abroad to a place that slaughters their chickens much older, they're all much tougher, and so they can be hard for us to eat because we're used to a tender chicken, and yet the flavor of chicken in them is greater. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. And that's why a lot of old French recipes work lousy with American chickens.
Right, exactly. And you know, why our soups are so bland, you know what I mean, compared to, like, because you get a real stewing hen, you know, and you get a lot of flavor out of one of those things, but, you know, they're kind of tough as nails to chew on. But I wonder whether it could be an age thing. I mean, it's possible that it's, Costco, I'm sure Costco is, like, you know, getting regular factory farm chickens, and that they're not going to be, there's not a lot of variance, you know?
This is the basic, I mean, it's foster farm chicken.
Right, right. And, you know, there's probably not a lot of variance in age or, and I wonder whether it could be like a pH thing, like a slaughter pH thing. I haven't done enough research on tenderness in chicken versus slaughter stress, for instance, to know kind of what happens. I mean, there's a lot of research, obviously, on slaughter stress and excessively soft, drippy meat for pork, right? But I don't really know of anything on chicken. That's interesting. Hopefully, maybe someone's listening that has had this experience and has done some research.
I would be very curious if anybody has an opinion, because, I mean, it's you know, if you put you think you need 6 breasts for however many people you're feeding, and then 4 of them come out, just 2 of them come out really funky, it really just sort of scrambles your plan.
Weird. Yeah, hopefully someone will call or write in with an explanation, because I'm curious. We don't have a Costco here in New York, so I can't go test it myself.
That's actually terrible, because other than this little problem, they're really nice. And then one more question back to the lamb. I got a little package of TPA of meat glue from your friends at your sponsors.
Modernist
you
Pantry.
That haven't even opened yet.
Right.
When I do this leg of lamb, can I TPA it back into its shape after I sear it? So could I open it up, sear it, and then bottle it up with TPA?
Sear the inside with meat glue?
Yeah.
With transglutaminase?
Yes.
Sear the inside. It's interesting. You can. You're not going to get as strong of a bond, right? And the meat isn't going to, unless you put like a lot of force on it with plastic wrap or a vacuum machine, it's going to be hard to get it to conform properly. Does that make sense? But
it does.
It can be done. Cooked meat will glue, just not as strongly.
All right. So I can roll it back up and actually get it to at least sort of stay.
Yeah. And remember to tightly seal the meat glue and put it back in the freezer to store it after it's open.
Okay, and so I did not know the story didn't freeze it, so yeah. That's very helpful.
Yeah. All right.
All right,
thank you
got
very
much.
Caller.
Oh, thank you very much. Thanks for calling in.
You're welcome. Bye.
All right, caller, you are on the air.
Hey, Dave, it's Mike from Denver, Colorado.
Hey, how are you? Doing all right. How you doing?
Good. Well, my question is kind of twofold. We make a lot of haphazard pickles at home, kind of like throw cabbage in, sprinkle salt, cabbage, salt.
Right.
And, you know, I'm curious if there's a bulletproof, because some of these we stick in the back of the fridge and, you know, you figure them out a month later, you taste them, they're a little funky, you know, but, you know, who knows whether it's actually safe, you know. Is there I've heard of a 5% salt solution, is generally safe, you know, and beyond that, you know, if you do a kimchi or something like that, will it actually keep indefinitely? Can you keep it for a year in there?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, indefinitely is a long time. I mean, these things tend to reach a peak and then can be kept for a long time afterwards without them becoming unsafe. The question is, do they taste as good to you? Do you know what I mean? So basically, you know, what you're trying to do is get the salt level, and I don't have it at the tip of my tongue because I always just kind of go and look it up when the time comes. It's you know, fairly easy to calculate roughly the salt level that you need based on, for instance, the weight of cabbage that you have. Right, and then pack the stuff together. As long as it stays submerged, right, so that you're not exposed to a lot of air, and the salt level is high enough, and then when the lactic acid bacteria start growing in there, you're going to have enough. It's the combination of the acidity and the salt that prevents nasty crap from growing in there over time, and it'll stay. Basically, yeah, you could keep it a year. You know, the question is it going to taste as good after that year is up? Now, I like to, rather than having to submerge things, I'll do a lot of vac pack, not to do a quick pickle, but a vac pack to do something like a kimchi. And then you can see the bags inflate with carbon dioxide. It's great. And then, you know, you don't have to worry about air getting to them ever because they're in a sealed bag. But that's not necessarily viable for home, which is why people tell you to weight the stuff down, or you know, put a plastic bag with water on top in it to weight the guy down. You know, another thing you can do to if you're having problems with funkiness, I mean, a lot of the issues, it sounds like you're using wild, you know, whatever happens to be around your kitchen is what you're inoculating the product with. So if you were,
I like a funky pickle. Kind of why I'm curious about it. You know,
funky pickle, I like that. But if you want something like that's consistent, then you can just save some of your pickling liquid from your old batch, right? And then after you mix in the salt and stuff, slop in. I mean, so like I have a brand of sauerkraut that I like, right? And so a lot of times I'll cheat because I know I like that brand of sauerkraut. And when I'm working on something, I'll save that sauerkraut juice and I'll dump that in along with the salt my cabbage to kickstart the you know, the particular cultures that those guys use because I happen to like it. So if you get a result that you happen to like, then you can backslop it into your next batch and you're guaranteed to get that same kind of a funkiness, assuming that you don't get a contamination and it's a robust enough starter culture so you can get it going. But in other words, that same thing that they do with the sourdough, you could do with a pickle in terms of a starter culture like that.
Oh, okay. And are you putting in salt via the raw weight of the cabbage, not the water?
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, a lot of the old recipes that you don't even add water to them, you know, they just kind of will liquid out over the course of the first, you know, day or so, and then you can press them. Or, yeah, I mean, you want that when you're calculating salt levels to prevent microbial spoilage, right? You're calculating on the final weight of total product, and then what percentage salt is that, right? Not the percentage of the brine, because, you know, imagine if you had even the most concentrated brine that you could possibly do in the 30s%, right? And then you were to put that, you know, teaspoon of that into a ton of cabbage, you haven't added any salt. Right.
Yeah.
So it's always best to calculate salt on weight of total product, water plus cabbage. And that way you know exactly where you are, and you're never going to go over, and you're never going to go under. You know, I like salty stuff, so the stuff that I do is probably always pretty safe. And you can get a feeling if it becomes acidic. Also, remember, the acidity is helping you, and you're going to have a lower salt requirement if your acidity level is high enough. You know, it's a multiple thing. If there's no acidity, you need a much higher salt concentration. Do you know what I'm saying?
Right.
Yeah.
Is there a good reference for that?
I'm sure there is. I don't have it off the tip of my tongue, but like any one of the agricultural extensions in the universities, they put out a lot of good pickling advice, and they'll usually give you both a salt level concentration and a pH concentration that you can deal with. I don't have like a website I can send it to right away, but you know, it's out there, and usually the ag extension guys are very conservative, so you don't have to worry about it. They're not pushing the envelope of what's safe, because otherwise they'd be in big trouble, and so their information is usually reliable.
Cool. I'll look into it.
All right. Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks a lot.
All right. So should we take a break, or do we have another caller?
No, but we're almost at the end here. And I have to read this because we've been distracted.
Read this. All right.
Today's show has been brought to you by The Modernist Pantry, supplying innovative ingredients for the modern cook. Do you love to experiment with new cooking techniques and ingredients, but hate to overspend for pounds of supplies when only a few grams are needed per application? Modernist Pantry has the solution. They offer a wide range of modern ingredients and packages that make sense for the home cook and enthusiast. And most only cost around $5, saving you time, money, and storage space. Whether you're looking for hydrocolloids, pH buffers, or even meat glue, you'll find it at Modernist Pantry. And if you need something they don't carry, just ask. Chris Anderson and his team will be happy to source it for you. With inexpensive shipping to any country in the world, Modernist Pantry is your one-stop shop for innovative cooking ingredients. Modernist Pantry carries unflavored popping candy, aka Pop Rocks.
Pop Rocks!
Fans of cooking issues that place an order of $25 or more before next week's show will get a free package of these exploding delights to play with. Simply use the promo code CI74. When placing your order online at modernistpantry.com.
Pop Rocks! Hey, so can I have a couple minutes, Jack, or are we rushing out of here?
We've got like 5 minutes, maybe.
All right, cool. So I met one of the guys who was on the initial development team of Pop Rocks at one of the classes I taught, and, you know, Mikey didn't explode. That didn't happen. But the way Pop Rocks are made is that CO2 is put under very high pressure into molten sugar. The sugar sets. Then they release the pressure. It explodes into little Pop Rocks thing. And inside of those frozen sugar granules are residual high pressure CO2. And that's what gives Pop Rocks its thingamajig. And although Mikey didn't explode, he did say that they put a whole load of Pop Rocks into a truck that developed a leak in transport, and it did kind of blow the side out of the truck. Don't know if it's true, but that's what he said. All right. So let me rip through the email question so that no one can say that I didn't pay attention to my email. People. Elliot Papineau, who we spoke about his knife work, knife sharpening the other day, ordered a walking horse strop, followed our recommendations, and bought a strop. See whether it's nice. His strop, Nastasha, made out of horse butt.
Wow.
Horse butt. Horse butt. Also got a shout out from Dan Main in the UK, who works for Dovebid, which is a company that I've always seen but I've never ordered. It makes me more nervous to order off of like a real auction site than it does to order off of eBay. But he sent us some links to a tablet press, which I desperately want a tablet press. If anyone wants to lend us a tablet press, he can do it. But check out Dovebid for all of your biopharma needs, which, again, we have them, which I don't really understand why we all have so many, but we do. Also, Tom Fisher in Lansdowne, PA, said he really loves what we're doing, and he realized last week when we were answering our questions that he loves what we're doing, and that the amount of knowledge we squeeze into a 45-minute show is incredible. Well, thank you. Thank you very much. And he basically says he's going in the Wayback Machine to last year when Nastasha was, against her best judgment, trying to make a pie crust with Crisco, and I said that lard is the only fat to use in such situations. Can lard be used in place of vegetable shortening in any recipe calling for vegetable shortening, or are there certain dishes where vegetable shortening is needed? And is it a one-to-one substitution by weight? The difference in vegetable shortening and lard is that lard is typically a lot softer than vegetable shortening, so it's more difficult to work, and you're going to be in certain situations where you need the hardness of a Crisco, otherwise your product becomes completely unworkable. That's why I tend to work very cold when I work with lard. Also, if you're using natural lard that's rendered out, it has like a liquid and a solid portion. It's much harder to use, but tastes much better than hydrogenated lard. Hydrogenated lard, the one you buy Armour in the store, Armour brand hydrogenated lard, is still more plastic than Crisco, more softer rather than Crisco, but much harder than real, honest-to-God lard. But yes, one-to-one substitution is best, and lard in biscuits is fantastic. Lard in I've never tried lard in a cookie instead of butter, because I use butter in a cookie. But anyway, yes, you can use lard. And referring back to my question last week about extracting fruit juice with a centrifuge, I noticed most brew supply companies sell pectin enzymes. Wikipedia seems to be saying that it's used for the same purposes as Pectinex Ultra SPL, breaking down pectin when making fruit juices. Can this be used in place of or to complement Ultra SPL, or am I barking up the wrong tree? Well, they're similar enzymes, but all the different pectinase enzymes that you can buy have different kinds of activities. And so even Novozymes, the people who make Pectinex Ultra SPL, have a range of different ones that have different kind of properties and different kind of activities. We use Ultra SPL because that's kind of like the most kind of shotgun one they have. It doesn't just take out pectin. It takes out hemicellulose and a bunch of other stuff. So any of these enzyme concoctions are kind of multiple enzyme brews that have various effects. And I use that one because it works over a wide range of pH on a wide range of substrates. You might be able to find one at a home brew that it works really well. I'm not sure. You're not barking up the wrong tree. It's just, you know, we have a lot of experience with Pectinex Ultra SPL, and so I tend to go to that one, and it's not that expensive for us to use because we buy it in bulk. Make sense? Makes sense? All right. Last in from Alvin J. Schultz in Houston, who apparently was on Top Chef something. I saw him. I looked him up. It was on Top Chef something. Anyway, thanks for all the info you shared with me via Cooking Issues. Also, congrats on Booker and Dax. I sent a bartender friend of mine in there this week, and he was blown away. I hope to stop by during the International Chef Conference this year myself. Please do. I have some questions about shopping for my first RotoVap. Because of my limited funding, I'm stuck with hunting through eBay ads. Anything I should be aware of in eBay auctions for RotoVaps? How do I properly clean one that may have been used in a lab? Do RotoVaps generate leak over time via worn seals, etc.? And what is the cost to restore one that may have such problems? I know Dave likes the cold finger style condenser. Does he just run those with a dry ice alcohol mix? I also have liquid nitrogen in my home kitchen. 30 liter, nice, huh? Liquid nitrogen in home kitchen? Nice. Would it be better to use that for condensing? How long will a cold finger fill with nitrogen before it last before it boils off? And lastly, I see many auctions like this and substitute in some kind of off-brand rotary evaporator. For a RotoVap under $1,000 on eBay, what's the catch with this seemingly Asian manufactured rotary evaporator? Thanks for your help. Also, I've ordered from your sponsors at modernistpantry.com, and they're great. Extremely fast shipping and nice usable packaging. Just wish they'd give a bigger discount for buying by the pound. All right. Well, I'd stay away from that crappy, RotoVap that's really cheap because I've used even name brand RotoVaps that aren't the good ones in the past, and they're leaky and they stink. And if you have a leaky RotoVap, it's going to be very hard to get a good flavor in it. And yes, they do tend to leak over time in their seals. New rotary seals, it costs about $50 to buy. You just want to get everything clean and make sure that the thing doesn't leak. If the glassware is etched so that it can't form a good seal, like it's scraped too much and etched, you're going to have a problem. But most of those problems with leaks can be fixed. But a leaky RotoVap is the first reason why you're going to lose flavor in a RotoVap. I do favor a cold finger condenser, but liquid nitrogen gets eaten at a ferocious rate. Every liter that you distill is going to take probably 7-8 liters of liquid nitrogen in a cold finger condenser. So you're going to be tearing through that 30 liter doer. That said, that's a really good way to do it. Dry ice is going to last you a lot longer. I don't use dry ice because it's hard for me to get dry ice in New York City. I have to take a cab and go to a place and then pick it up and then come back, blah, 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 because I don't own a car, et cetera, et cetera. So if you're in Houston, you own a car, and you have access, I would use dry ice in a cold finger because it's going to last a lot longer. You can get one on eBay. That's how I got my first one. And You can fix most leaks. You want to make sure that nothing nasty went through it. You're going to want to clean it with Alkanox or some really hardcore glass detergent. Bleach the hell out of it, even though it's probably more of a poison in it than a biohazard. It's probably going to be more of a poison issue. But just clean the ever-loving hell out of that son of a gun, because I don't want you to be sucking in a bunch of carbon tetrachloride or crazy poison stuff. Poison! Cooking issues!
Fish and vodka. Oh, you did.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
Fish is vodka.